Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. And with me in the studio, Mike Maddox, Rock County UW Extension horticulture educator, who is headquartered at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, Wisconsin. Mike, pleasure to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And you brought along Chrissy Register, Walworth County UW Extension horticulture educator in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. Chrissy, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you.
So if people have questions about their gardens, this is the time to call. If you're in Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. First off, Chrissy, your first time here. It's great to see you.
Yes, it is. Thank you. It's great to be here and great to be able to share with the community.
What kind of trouble calls are you getting from gardeners these days?
I would say the main ones, of course, are their Japanese beetles. We're seeing a lot of powdery mildew on a wide variety of plants, and certainly our gypsy moth population in Walworth County is pretty high this year.
Mm-hmm. Mike, pretty much the same thing?
Or? With Rock County being right next to Walworth, yeah, it's a lot of the same problems, but I would have to add the cicada killer wasp has been frightening people left and right down through our area.
When you say cicada killer wasp, now are you talking about one insect?
They tend to swarm when you do find them. Yeah, the cicada killer wasp, many people have seen it out there. It's about an inch and a half, 2 inches long, yellow and black, pretty fierce looking, and they're usually in swarms, and they tend to be a little aggressive when you walk into their colonies, but they're, I wouldn't get too frightened of them. They're not going to sting you unless you start swatting at them and that. And they're killing the cicadas, the dog day cicadas that are mm-hmm. out there. I've been getting a lot of calls from frightened parents, pet owners about how to deal with that. And I would also have to add squash vine borer with everyone starting to look at their pumpkins that are coming along and the other cucurbits and everything that you're like, oh, that's ready to harvest. Then all of a sudden people are watching the vine collapse. And if you were to look, you'd see a little borer in the stem, and it's getting some gardeners very irritated.
What do you do if you find that kind of collapse going on in the stem?
At this stage, you complain a lot. That's something that needs to be dealt with earlier in the season when females are starting to lay their eggs earlier in the year. You can do something to the stem there to protect it. Otherwise, crop rotation is a good thing. I think a caller at one time suggested planting radish around the stems. I have yet to verify the accuracy in that, but at this stage, there's nothing else you can do other than just plan accordingly for next year.
Okay. Calls are starting to come in. Let's take people's calls and see what's on their mind. Let's start with Lenny in Green Bay. Hi, Lenny.
Good morning. I had a question regarding the little fruits that form on potato plants with the seeds in them. I guess two questions. One would be, is that when you buy a certified seed potato, is that generated from those seeds? And also, what if somebody did want to start potatoes from seed like that, what would be the way to go about that?
Well, I'm not a potato grower. I'm not 100% sure, but yes, that little fruit you do see is where the seed is coming from, and certified seed is meaning that it's been tested and bred and selected to give you the potatoes that you're wanting. What you're going to harvest from there, I'm going to believe, is not certified. Again, I'm not a potato grower to know. Typically, when I do my potatoes, I'm doing it from eyes that I get from the garden center. You are more than welcome to try to grow those yourself. I'm not sure what you're going to get. And if you have access to the internet, I am sure you're going to find instructions on how you can harvest those seeds, prepare them for next year, and to use them that way.
Chrissy, anything to add to that?
Well, I think Mike was correct on that, and I've seen a lot of times the seeds don't always be true to form when you're dealing with your vegetable crops and using your seeds that's coming from your plant that you have certified seed from. Mm-hmm. So I would certainly go ahead and take a look at the internet and find out more information on that seed.
We've got a master gardener who is coaxing some of our potatoes along that are going to seed, and he's going to try that. So I'm sure next year I'm going to know more of what the outcome of this will be.
All right, Lenny. Thanks very much for your call. Good luck to you. And let's go to Jennifer next in La Crosse. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have actually just one question about my neighbor's pussy willow tree. I just happened to run into her earlier today, and she's going out of town, so I said I would call you guys for her. But the bush is about 10 feet tall and about 8 feet in diameter. It looks very lush and beautiful, but at the base, it has this kind of scaly, white, powdery stuff that's been coming around for about 3 weeks, maybe 1 month. She noticed it about 3 weeks ago. And she's also noticing some white powdery substances just on some of the leaves on the very tips. And she has tried some organic chemical. She didn't know exactly what it was. She tried it 1 week, let it settle in, and then she tried it a second week, and it doesn't seem to have done anything.
Mm-hmm.
And she also has some tiny little brown insects that are building up on the leaves as well. And she's just wondering what she might be able to do to get rid of both of those things and to try to go as chemical-less as possible.
It sounds to me like there may be some aphid problems going on the leaf tissue, and that can certainly be, if you can get a picture of an aphid and identify that for sure, that can certainly be taken care of with just a soap and water combination. And also on the white powdery, maybe powdery mildew, if the powder is, you know, it has a fine texture, it certainly will cover the whole surface of the leaf, and that comes on a lot of times with the moisture content in the air. This time of the year, we see it in a lot of different plants, and certainly on a control, really, there's nothing you can do after the fungus gets onto the leaf. That's more of a preventative control that you would take, but certainly getting a lot of air circulation onto the pussy willow certainly will help that. And throughout the year, you should see a decline.
Just cut those branches that are infected off?
I don't think you have to necessarily cut them off, but I would just watch them. And you may want to, if the leaves do fall, you may want to remove those leaves so that the spores don't accumulate more on the new leaves coming out.
All right. Good luck to you, Jennifer. Thank you very much for the call, and good luck to your neighbor. As we talk today with Mike Maddox and Christine Register, they are UW Extension horticulture educators, and let's go next to John in Gays Mills. Hi, John. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I'm a tomato grower, and I'm looking to switch into a hoop house, not a full-blown greenhouse, just a hoop house. And was wondering if your experts had any advice to somebody who was about to switch over to that type of operation.
Yeah, my advice is check your local zoning to make sure you can put one up. Your zoning can, for the county, can change from county to county, and there may be some restrictions on what kind of structures you put up. What they're made
of. Dane County Farmers Market, you know, heirloom varieties, and they're just so susceptible to disease and whatnot. And if I can put them in a hoop house with drip irrigation,
that will be very helpful. Yes,
you know, I can get rid of the rain, which is where most of your problems are come from.
Yeah, for hoop house growing, boy, you might want to look into some high tunnel information. And again, with access to the internet, you can find a lot more than what I'm going to be able to tell you here online. But look up some hoop house information, look into some high tunnels. We've had some colleagues up in the Green Bay area doing some work with high tunnels.
What is a high tunnel?
It's like a hoop house with foldies, with sides that can fold up. It's actually pretty nifty.
Okay.
I also think West Madison, the Ag Research Station here in Madison, has done some work on that too. So you can actually go check some out.
Okay.
There's also some commercial fruit growers or vegetable growers. Organizations, I would confer with them on what their experience has been. I don't do a lot of work with the fresh market vegetable producers. You know, the home gardener tends to where I go. But if I can steer you towards some of those commercial groups, they're going to give you the information you need. We also have a couple of publications through UW Extension about the commercial production of vegetables that you should probably get your hands on, read them through, and they'll guide you into that information.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. Again, the number for you to call if you're in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 1-800-642-1234. And our next caller is Joe in Stoughton. Hi, Joe. What's on your mind?
I've got a question about pruning climbing roses. I have a trellis that is the entrance to my backyard. In other words, you walk underneath it. Mm-hmm. And I've got a John Cabot or Henry Kelsey climbing rose. I can't remember which variety. One's planted on either side. And they've been in there about 3 years. And every spring, I usually go in and cut out a couple of the largest canes down near the base and then sort of reduce the overall size of the plant down to about 4 or 5 feet. I have no idea if I'm doing that right or wrong, but my point is that it grows fine, and then this time of year, the canes literally outgrow the trellis and sort of shoot up 4 or 5 feet beyond the top of the trellis, and I suppose I could weave them over the top, but then what's going to happen next year? I mean, presumably they're going to keep growing and will have clearly already outgrown this trellis. So I guess I'm just wondering, am I even pruning them the right way? Should I be cutting the whole rose plant down to the ground, or is it just the nature of the beast, or what?
Well, that's a good question. I think that with the climbing roses, they are pretty aggressive, especially when they have, the good soil and the good fertilizer to grow. And I think that you're right in pruning out some of the heaviest canes each year. And some selective pruning throughout the year would be, I think it would be very good for the rose itself. And when you're pruning the roses, just make sure that your pruning cuts are, the actual angle of the cut is away from your bud so that you don't have that water draining out over your pruning cut and onto your bud. That'll prevent some of your diseases and some of your funguses from growing there. But I think you're doing correctly. And if it's getting a little bit too out of control, too wacky, just, do some selective pruning here and there and retrain that onto your trellis. I think that would work out.
I say you haven't killed it yet, so you're doing something right. I think if it's growing that vigorously, to do some controlled cuts is a good idea. I would not do much more pruning for this time of year. You want to get all your pruning done by mid-August so you don't spur on any more growth that's going to have issues hardening off before the fall actually rolls around.
All right, great, thanks.
Okay, Joe, thank you very much for your call, and let's move on to Errol in Millston. Hi.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I have a question. I planted a miniature bottle brush shrub, about 3 years ago, and every spring, I have a frog here.
Yeah.
Every spring, I get time release stakes and put by it, and in the 3 to 4 years that it's been in the ground, it's not showing any signs of any blossom. Could you tell me what I might be doing wrong on that?
Well, you could be over-fertilizing it, because you did say you put down fertilizer stakes around it.
Just one.
Yeah, typically you don't need to put those in around your shrubs like that. And if you give a shrub, and I'm just talking in general here, if you give a flowering plant too much fertilizer, especially in the nitrogen range or the nitrogen type, it's not going to produce flowers for you. As for bottlebrush buckeye, I have had some experience with that. It is fairly slow growing. It is fairly conservative. I put one in at my folks' house. It's been in the ground 3 to 4 years and just now is producing flowers regularly. I think you just want to make sure it's getting enough light. It can take some dappled light, full sun, it does really well in. Make sure it stays well watered. And I wouldn't worry about the fertilizer spikes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good luck. Yep. Cross your fingers. Be patient.
Patient is the key word.
Be a good gardener. We're talking about gardening today with Mike Maddox, Rock County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, and Chrissy Register, Walworth County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. Martinez White is our on-air producer. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Garden Talk program. Glad to have you with us today. And if you have a question for our guests, the number for you to call in Madison is 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. We've been talking about seed potatoes and tomatoes, and we'll be happy to take your call as well about gardening. Let's go to Just next in Fitchburg. Hello, Just. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, can you hear me okay?
We can.
About trumpet vines. I really love hummingbirds, and I wanted to plant these trumpet vines to attract them. I've got both red and orange. I planted three of them, and I was planning on creating kind of like some arbors or some archways in my yard. And then I went to a friend's house who's got trumpet vines that are quite old, and he said it was the biggest mistake he ever made because they're so invasive, they're coming up out of his grass into other plants, and it's making me a little bit nervous about kind of the ultimate, outcome.
Listen to your friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. The trumpet vine, it's great for attracting hummingbirds, like what you said, but it does tend to take over everything.
Really?
Yep.
Okay, are there any other suggestions you'd have then for attracting hummingbirds that would be an equally beautiful kind of flower, maybe a vine if possible?
Yeah, any of your vines that have the reddish to orange flower with a long tubular part of the flower is really great for your hummingbirds. That includes some of your bee balms. Pardon me. And there's actually a publication through the extension called Attracting Birds and Butterflies, and that lists some of the other alternatives to attracting them.
And the online website, is it not CE Commerce, the initial cecommerce.uwex.edu?
They've actually changed the name to something of the Learning Store.
The Learning Store, .uwex.edu.
Typically, when I try to find it, I just type in the Learning Store Wisconsin Extension in Google, and it comes up.
And it comes right up.
All right. Are there any other specific items that you would suggest? Any examples of flowers that would be off the top of your head good ones?
Boy, off the top of my head, I'm drawing a blank, but I just know when I sit out in my backyard, I'm getting hummingbirds shooting all over the place, and I'm trying to think what I have. I do have some of the bee balms that they're visiting those. I've got them on just a wide variety of flowers, and I would encourage you to look at that publication.
Yeah.
And again, access to the internet, you can type in gardening for butterflies and hummingbirds and get
and
things
you'll
there.
Be there.
All right.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, Jess, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's go next to Clark in Dale. Hi, Clark.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I live in the middle of 50 acres. About 40 are Conservation Reserve Program, tall grass prairie, 10 years old. We don't have many trees around. About 6 or 7 years ago, I planted a white oak, and it has been producing acorns. This summer, we've had acorns sprouting up all over our lawn, probably 100 of them. Who's planting them? We don't have any squirrels.
Well, I would first say the squirrels, but since you say there are none, there's probably some squirrels around that area, and there's certainly chipmunks and things like that that live in the prairie that sometimes are not visible to us because they're, of course, on the ground. And if it's a tall grass prairie, you know, they may be crawling around and you may not even see them. But certainly it's most likely some sort of the squirrels that are doing that. Also in the tall grass prairie, if you have, if all that vegetation's falling down and those seeds can actually get pushed into the soil since that soil is very organic, and throughout the winter, if there's any cracks or anything like that, if any of those acorns fall in there, certainly they can get worked in the soil that way too. But I would suspect something like a squirrel would be doing that for you.
I could probably buy chipmunks, but because we have had a few, but I also have 5 dogs running loose in the yard.
Well, it's the dogs that are doing it.
No, I don't think so.
You'd be surprised. They sneak out there at night and plant them on you. Who knows? Because there's a number of nighttime critters that can be moving through your yard.
Yes.
They could be coming through that way too.
Yeah.
And can you give me an idea of the best way to transplant these? I bought a bunch of fiber pots and potting soil. Is this
to do the oak seedlings early in the spring would be a good time to do it. You'd want to do them the first year of growth before there's too much of a taproot you have to contend with, but even then it's going to be something you have to wrestle with. When the oak seedling forms, it's going to have primarily a taproot and not a lot of a diffuse root system up above. And if you transplant it, sever too much of the taproot at that seedling stage before that diffuse root system is in place, you're probably going to fail at the transplanting stage. So I would suggest trying to at least undercut it when the first year you notice them. So come in with a shovel blade, just kind of slice underneath them, hoping to sever the taproot. And I would almost say leave them in place for that year to see if they are going to grow. If they do, then they'll throw out that fibrous root system up top that you can then harvest it and transplant it that way. And I would do all that work in the spring.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Clark, thanks very much for your call. Again, the number for you if you're in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. That's toll free. And our email address, talk@wpr.org. We do have a line open for your call, but let's go to Mike next in DeKalb. Hi, Mike.
Thank you. The question that I have is, this year, it seems that our tomato crop has a number of black dots on the tomatoes. And I've not seen this in years past, and talking with others in the community, they're seeing the same on some of their tomatoes, and I was just wondering if there was something that I could look for or do next year to prevent that.
I'm seeing it. Aren't you seeing it too, Chrissy?
I'm seeing it.
Yeah, and what are we saying? It's bacterial speck for a lot of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's bacteria speck. There's the septoria leaf spot. Of course, there's you've had maybe if your watering's been a little heavy, if you've been dry, sometimes you'll get the blossom end rot. But our tomatoes really across the state have just been showing very stressful signs of diseases this year.
They are ugly as can be. As for what to do, though, this is a lot of times caused by the weather. And actually, with our spring rains that we had a lot of those spores spread around at that time, and they're just now starting to emerge on the tomatoes now. There's not a lot you can do. You could try some of your fungicides on the healthy-looking tissues, but I wouldn't really recommend that because you're still going to have the problems persist. For the most part, especially with the bacterial speck that I'm seeing on the tomato fruits, they're still edible. I'm just thankful I'm not trying to sell these things because they are spotty looking. And you'd really think twice before purchasing one, but from the consuming point of view, there is no issue with them.
Mm-hmm. Just cut out the black spot and
I was eating them.
Yeah.
Added
and
texture.
You look fine.
Yeah, nothing's happened to me yet. As for just general tomato culture, you should always rotate your crops. If you have room to grow your tomatoes in a different spot each year, do that. That helps to cut back on the re-inoculation of the plant for disease. Consider using a mulch to suppress diseases on the ground to keep them from splashing onto the leaves. And when you are watering, make sure you keep the leaves dry. Do not wet the leaves down if you can. Do a lot of basal watering, and that will be another way to reduce disease in your plant.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
That'll be very helpful for next year then.
All right, Mike. Thanks very much for your call. Appreciate that. That's when the water wand becomes so helpful to a gardener.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if you could even have a drip irrigation system, that's on my wish list for the farm, is to just direct that moisture right to the roots and keep it off of the plant itself. That's ideal way of watering tomatoes.
Mike Maddox and Chrissy Register are our guests today on Garden Talk. And let's go to Greg next in Waupaca. Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I have some cabbages that were growing for my son's third grade school project. And the leaves are having like little holes, real small holes all over them. And we can't figure out what's causing that. Is that a common problem with cabbage?
Yeah. Yeah, the cabbage has a lot of insect issues. There's a cabbage moth that can do some damage to them. I believe there's a flea beetle that can do some damage to them. You need to be creative with growing cabbage. You can try floating row covers over them to keep the insects off. You can try your pesticides. But if you're just doing a small crop of them, I'd consider just using a cheesecloth over the top of them in order to keep the insects off. Again, a lot more detail on that in our UW Extension publications about growing some of these crops.
Okay.
All right.
They seem to come back after a while if you like.
Again, for the most part, especially the flea beetle damage, if that's the case, it is mostly cosmetic.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
All right, Greg, thank you for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. And Teresa is next. And Shitek. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Thank you. I have sweet pea plants that are just huge and gorgeous, but there are no blossoms on them. Is there something I can do to get them to blossom?
Is this your first year having them?
Well, actually, I've tried sweet peas other years and not had very good luck, so I just decided I'd try it again this year.
I would check with your fertilizer and maybe have a soil test done to see exactly what's going on in your soil, and just giving it a good fertilizer may be the trick to get those blossoms there.
Okay. Because my, you know, garden peas that I grow, I get, you know, peas on them, and it's in a similar area.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, if you are fertilizing and using too much nitrogen with them, that might be the issue.
Okay, well, we have chickens, and we use mostly chicken manure in the garden. So.
I think we're honing in on the problem there. That tends to be nitrogen-rich, and again, when you put down too much nitrogen, it's going to push vegetative growth, leafy growth, and not so much your flowers.
Yes. Well, I haven't, you know, actually put any new fertilizer in that area, but it's been fertilized often with chicken manure. So
I guess that's where that soil test would be really important then.
Right.
Well, unfortunately, though, a soil test doesn't reveal the amount of nitrogen in a soil. It's going to tell you the amount of phosphorus and potassium. It's going to tell you your pH and organic matter, but it's really difficult to test for actual nitrogen.
Uh-huh.
It'll give you a suggested rate of nitrogen application based on the type of plant you're growing and what we know about a plant's nitrogen needs. But if you've got too much nitrogen in the area, unfortunately, a soil test does not tell you lay off the nitrogen.
Okay.
It'll just give you a best guess based on what you report. So if you have put nitrogen down in the past, the manure down in the past, I would not do it again for a while because chicken manure tends to be a little rich.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Very concentrated.
Okay.
All right, Teresa, good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. As we talk today on Garden Talk with Mike Maddox and Chrissy Register, Kathy's next in Gillette. Hi, Kathy. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I'd like either of these people to move in with me, actually. But I'll start with the first question that I have, and if it takes long, I'll just hold my other ones for another time. But if I have an area of sod that I've tilled the grass on by covering it for the whole season, and I want to change that to wildflowers for next year, I've read that you should not till, and yet that grass and all their roots is still there, so I'm not sure how that works.
Well, you have to, first of all, make sure that grass is going to be, of course, dead. But certainly, you're going to probably, if you're going to put it into that sort of growing method, you probably want to, you're going to have weeds, obviously. But tilling or not tilling is going to be the issue with, you know, if you break up, if the root's totally not dead in the grass and then you break that all up, you may have some more resprouting going on with your grasses. And I think the tilling will also depend on what kind of soil you have.
But are you saying do or don't till?
I'm interpreting that as it depends. And I know that's not helpful. How do you plan on establishing that flower bed? Are you planning on doing it by seed, or are you planning on doing it by transplants?
Yes.
If you're going to do it by seeds, the best way to get those seeds to germinate is to ensure good seed-soil contact. So if that's the case, tilling might be the way to do it. You'll need to till it up, break up the soil particles on top, and rake out any large clods that may have formed to sow those seeds in there. If you decide to do the wildflowers through transplants, I don't see why you couldn't just cut through the sod that you've killed off and plant in around that, and then come in with maybe a light mulch to cover it all up to suppress weed growth in the end.
Okay, my next question is about mulching, because mulch also encourages those darn earwigs, which eat the flower stems and the flowers. So is that a...
Gardening encourage earwigs. I mean, rocks can encourage earwigs. Earwigs are going to come whether you mulch or not. And mulch just gets a really horrible rap for that. Mulch does a lot of good things for your plants and for the soil.
But everything you read about how to stop the earwig damage says remove the mulch.
Well, if that's the case, I've given up gardening. Mulch, the benefits of mulch outweighs the bad of earwigs, in my opinion. It traps moisture in the soil. It helps protect the roots of the plant. It actually can break down and act as a slow-release fertilizer. It suppresses weeds. Mulch does a lot of good things. If you are concerned about earwigs, you know, you can try a pesticide if you want. You can try diatomaceous earth around them. You can roll up newspapers and put those out there at night, and in the morning go out there. And in that roll-up newspaper, you can take them and shake them out of that newspaper into a bucket of soapy water. Mm. But there's a lot of things you can do for the earwigs, but one thing I would not do is give up on mulch. And I've had arguments over the phone with gardeners about the benefits of mulch versus earwigs. I get pretty heated about that topic.
Sure. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, good luck with it.
If you want Mike to move in with you, I don't think you want to get him mad by taking all the mulch off the garden.
When I moved into my house, the first thing I did was ripped out all the rock mulch that was there and put down wood mulch, a pet peeve of mine.
All right, let's go back to the phones to Paul in Green Bay next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Larry and guest. Thanks for taking the call. I have a lilac, and I've had it for 8 years. It's got a beautiful crown, beautiful leafing, but I've never had a bud on it. It gets about 5 hours of direct sun a day. It's kind of on the west-facing side of the house. What am I doing wrong?
Have you been pruning your lilac at all?
Yes.
What time of year do you prune?
Well, since I don't have blossoms, I can't prune after the blossoms. So
that's right.
But, generally in the spring, and then I get a lot of these, little shoots off of the bottom, and I try to keep that down so at least I have a decent-looking tree bush.
Well, lilacs are spring flowering shrub, so what the key is to not prune in the fall. If you prune in the fall, then you'll actually be cutting off the next year's flower buds. And that actually goes from about middle of summer all the way through the fall. So if any pruning is happening along that time frame, you're going to be pruning off your flower buds for the following year. So I would maybe hold off on the pruning for a year and then see what happens.
I'll do that.
Yeah, well, and you also said 5 hours of light. Of direct sun.
Well, I mean, obviously it gets daylight, but in 5 hours of pretty much direct sun.
They do bloom best when in full sun. And I
knew that.
Yeah, so it may not be enough light. You could be cutting the blossoms off. So I would put the pruners away for a year and see how it responds and then make a decision.
Thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm. Good luck to you. Thanks, Paul. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number for you is 263-1890 or 800-642-1234 as we talk with Chrissy Register and Mike Maddox. Mike, I know you've got an event coming up in a couple of weeks that you're going to bring a lot of people to the Rotary Gardens.
Yeah. On September 6th, the Rock Prairie Master Gardener Association is hosting the third annual Garden Festival. And it consists of free tomato taste testing. We grow about 50 varieties of heirloom tomatoes and invite people in to taste test them. We also did a hot pepper collection this year, and we're still trying to decide what we're going to do for those. I think we might just have a bunch of pretty peppers out people can enjoy. We are also this year combined with Arborfest, which is the Janesville Shade Tree Advisory Committee's festival on trees. They are becoming part of the Garden Festival, and we'll be having ongoing education programs regarding tree ID, tree inspection, etc. We'll have our Janesville Area Herb Society doing fried green tomatoes, which that's, I think, like the best part of it all, and that's free taste testing of those. We will have our County Home and Community Educators Association doing recipes and preservation demos for everyone. So we'll have a lot of, it's free to the public. It's free education, free taste testing. We're also experimenting this year with like a taste of Rock County, and we're working with area restaurants and caterers to do some samples of garden fresh produce that people can pick up at a nominal cost. I'm asking for $3 and under, so they can graze on all these recipes of stuff using stuff fresh from the garden. That is September 6th from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. We'll be doing everything while supplies last, so please come early if you do consider doing it. And I am trying to put up information as it comes in on the Rotary Gardens website, so I'll have all the details, and it's probably updated again today. But that's at www.rotarygardens.org if people want more information on that.
And again, the Rotary Gardens located on Palmer Drive in Janesville, sort of situate that for people coming off the interstate.
Oh, well, if you're coming down off the interstate, you take exit 175A, and which that'll take you right into Janesville, and it's the very first stoplight you come to. It's not even a mile off the interstate. You turn left onto Palmer Drive at that interstate, and as you're going down that road, you go about another quarter mile, and you're going to see it.
Mike Maddox, Chrissy Register, our guest today. Leah in Coleman actually wanted to know if there is a surefire way to tell when watermelons are ripe. How do you tell if a watermelon is ripe, Chrissy?
I would say I am not very much of a grower of watermelon, and certainly this is actually my first year doing it personally. And I would say the best way to do it is if it comes out off the vine very easily, that's when it's usually ripe, and that goes for a lot of the squash plants. And so certainly when the vine that's connected to your watermelon is just about turning a little bit of a brownish color, usually your watermelon's ready to go. Mm-hmm. Mike, you have any?
Do you use the thump test, Mike?
Oh, I'm always pounding on the fruit out there. Not always a great success. I would say the surefire way of telling is you cut it open.
You cut it open.
But
right.
That's not going to do you any good if it's not ripe enough. No, you look for the vine. It should come off fairly easy. Thump test. I've heard some people say you look at the spot on the ground from where it's sitting. I've harvested them before, and they're just not ripe enough. But, you know, we still manage to eat them.
Yeah. And with a muskmelon, well, then, of course, you've got the aroma. You've got that smell that's mm-hmm. going to tell you right away.
Yeah. Unfortunately for us at the community garden that I work with, I have a half-acre garden that I work with jail inmates with the Rock County Sheriff's Department. We've been having the trouble the last couple of years with a lot of our vine crops. So, unfortunately, I haven't had a lot of experience recently testing to see if the fruit's good because we're just not getting the things to grow. We've got just some issues out there we're contending with.
All right, let's go to the phone to Lou in Milwaukee next. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question regarding climate zones. I live literally 50 yards from Lake Michigan in the Milwaukee area. And my friends and I have this discussion occasionally. We are thinking due to climate change, and maybe not just that, that we're becoming more of a zone 5.5 to 6 than we are a zone 5. For example, I have a oak willow, which is a zone 6 plant, and Alaskan cedar, which I believe is a zone 6, and they're thriving in my backyard facing the lake. And just wanted your comments on that. If you feel that the zones have moderated a little bit, and the difference between growing things right on Lake Michigan, let's say, than growing things in Madison as far as what you can grow.
Well, they did recently redo the USDA cold hardiness zones. They re-averaged the average lows for winters, and that did adjust some of the growing zones out there, where I think you can say we have become a little bit warmer that way, according to the zoning. That said, there is still always the potential for a really cold winter, as we're coming off a record winter, at least for snowfall, that if you were to plant a zone 6 plant up in our area, there still is the potential we can get a winter cold enough in order to knock it back. But if you look at the garden centers around here in this place, and we're obviously not on the lake like you are, we're seeing a lot more of these Central Illinois plants, and that's where I grew up, so I'm familiar with a lot of these. They're coming up here and are starting to be for sale at the garden centers. You know, Japanese maple's the best example. We're starting to see a lot of Japanese maples for sale in this, and we're just not talking the cold hardy blood goods. So there is a trending towards plants with a labeled for a warmer zone to be grown up here, and it is being reflected in the cold hardiness zones. But I would always warn people, we still have the potential for the traditional colds that could wipe those out of your garden.
Right. We push it. I mean, there are things that we'll plant that we'll say, well, we'll see if it'll make it. Maybe it won't make it. But yeah. I do know that, for example, I can plant rhododendrons in my yard, and they're all over my neighborhood, and they've been prolific the last 4 years. But if I travel inland 15 miles, you see very few of them, because I think the lake just helps just that little bit.
Yeah, definitely the lake effect is going to work to your advantage, and you just said something in there that shows you're a sign of a true gardener is you push the limits.
And sure.
And any gardener is pushing the limits. Oh, I'm going to try that. If it dies, it dies.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much.
All right, Lou, thank you very much for your call. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller. Martinez White is our on-air producer today. Mike Maddox and Chrissy Register are our guests, and we'll be back to take more of your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard in on Garden Talk today. Glad to have you with us as we pursue answers to gardening questions. And with us, Mike Maddox from the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, the Rock County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. And Chrissy Register from Elkhorn is the Walworth County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. And if you have a question, they'll be happy to try to answer it. In Madison, the number is 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. We did have an email that arrived after our last garden talk. A woman has two large choke cherries as tall as the house that ended up with chewed up leaves, and she's wondering what may be doing this. They're about 12 years old, have been losing limbs in the last few years. It looks like the base of the limb is slightly rooted. Is the tree getting too old? Should we let some of the suckers grow to replace the older main trunk? If you got this call, Chrissy, what would you think?
Well, I'd first say that it may have some, the new growth, you wouldn't want to maybe take use that because it may be coming from a root graft where the tree was grafted initially. So those won't be the same tree that you have right now growing. And as far as the leaves being eaten, that could be, depending on what it looks like, it could be something like the Japanese beetle. It could have, there's lots of different insects out there that'll feed on the leaf tissue.
Chew away on the leaf tissue.
Right.
Okay. And is 12 years old, how is that in terms of the life expectancy of chokecherry?
12 years is still pretty young. I would say maybe a good pruning here and there just to get it under control would be a good thing to do at that stage.
Is there a best time for pruning in this situation?
For chokecherries, I would say early spring, some dormant pruning would be fine on a chokecherry.
Okay. Let's go to the phones to Jane and Galena. Hello, Jane.
Hi. How are you?
Very good. How about you?
Pretty good, thanks. I have a question about moving roses. Is this a good time of year or not? I want to move my roses and intermingle them with other plants.
Is it easier to move the other plants around your roses?
No.
Okay. All right. How long have those roses been in place?
About 3 to 4 years.
Okay, so there's probably some root system down that you're going to sever when you move it.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I've killed more roses. I don't know if you want my advice on this one. I think that it is better to either wait till the plant goes dormant or do it earlier in the spring. That's my opinion coming from someone who kills the plants. Keep in mind that roses do like ventilation.
Okay.
So when you put your companion plants around it, that's going to hinder some of the airflow that might increase some of your leaf spot diseases on the roses.
Okay.
Make sure you're moving them to the place where they get drainage, but you can water them well.
Right. Roses... I want to move them around my foundation of my house.
I don't know if they're going to like that.
Oh.
Because foundations tend to have a lot of compacted soil around them, and they may not be super happy. Yeah, you might have a great foundation. I don't know. But if you, that might be an issue.
Okay.
Just keep in mind, roses, like all plants, are not furniture. They don't like to be moved around.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Jane. And we're getting information we don't usually get, the references to moving furniture, for instance.
You caught me in a wily mood today, I guess.
Bruce and Stevens Point, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a watering question also. We just moved up here, and basically we're in the Central Sands. I've done a little bit of homework on this, but not much. We're in the Central Sands, and it's August, which I think statistically is the driest month of the year. And our grass is turning brown. And we lived in Door County for a long time, and I know we were in bedrock there, and the same thing happened. We've been told that basically the grass will die, and everybody here waters their grass, which is, I'm thinking I'm in Las Vegas all of a sudden. But do you really have to water your grass? Or I'm thinking it's just gone dormant. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The grass will go dormant. And the grass goes dormant across the state, southern Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin. In the drier periods, the grass goes dormant, and that's normal for how our seasons go here. A normal watering schedule is about maybe in the sandier soils, maybe an inch and a half a week. If you have a sprinkler out there, throw a tuna can or something like that that can accumulate the water, and you can measure your water so you're not putting too much, because it'll certainly drain through that your sandy soils a little bit more than if you had a clay or more organic soil than you have there. But I think the dormancy is normal. If the neighbors want to water, you know, they're going to water if they want green grass right now. But it's actually, you know, it's okay for your grass to go dormant. It'll come back.
Yeah, and I'd like to follow up on that, too, because we are growing primarily Kentucky bluegrass. It's a cool season grass. It's going to grow in the spring and the fall at its best. When it gets too hot, it goes dormant. Let it go dormant. It makes for a healthier grass. I just want to use this as an opportunity to talk about, though, do some watering of your trees and shrubs, especially your evergreen type. We are coming up to winter, and we want to make sure they are properly hydrated so they can get through the winter months with good moisture content in the leaves, and that's going to minimize that winter burn that we'll see in the spring from when those plants may dry out. So we want to keep our trees, our shrubs, especially those evergreen types with the needles that stay on all year long, make sure you're watering those, and do exactly what Chrissy just said. Put a sprinkler on in the area, put a tuna can out in the area to measure the water. When it's filled, you put out about an inch. Do that about once a week, and that's going to help you keep your plants hydrated, and I would say do that up to about the time the ground freezes, and that's going to help you out a lot for your for the trees and shrubs.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Bruce, thank you very much. Appreciate your call, and good luck to you. Debbie's in Loganville. Hello, Debbie. What can we do for you today?
Hi. I'm growing radicchio. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of salad green. And on the seed packet, it says that the leaves form a small, beautiful, deep red head. The picture looks like small red cabbages. But what's in my garden looks like romaine. What do I need to do to make it form heads?
When did you sow those seeds?
Oh, I think it was early June or very late May.
Early June, late May. And you still got them coming along?
Oh, yes. Okay. You know, I've been picking off the leaves. If I just cut them to a stump, would it then maybe form a head?
You know, I don't grow radicchio. I don't, so I'm not really sure. Are you eating it already?
Oh, yeah. I've been eating it all summer.
And does it taste fine?
Well, if you like romaine, which yeah. I don't that much.
Okay. like I said, I don't grow it, but uh-huh. if it's not even tasting the way you like it, if you're not liking the taste of it, pull it up and start over again. Try it out again. I'm not real sure how to answer that one, other than maybe take a picture and pass it by somebody who grows radicchio to see that's actually what it is.
Okay, well, maybe somebody will call in who knows about radicchio. You know, I'm thinking that maybe there's something I can do to make it form heads. But
yeah.
It certainly isn't doing that now, nor has it done that, you know, earlier in the summer.
I was going to say, if another caller doesn't come in, and I'll say this for any question that comes in that we don't have an answer for, take it to your local county extension office, have the master gardeners locally do some research and to help you out to find the answers to your questions.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. And they don't charge for that, do they?
No.
All right. Good luck to you, Debbie. Thanks very much. We appreciate your call. The number for you, to get in on Garden Talk today in Madison is 263-1890 or toll free at 800-642-1234. Jim's next in Winneconnie. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is, I've got a 3-year-old apple orchard, and I was tired of mowing under it, so I mulched the whole thing, even between the trees, with pine needles. Is that a good thing?
You are doing good horticulture, I would say. Mulch is always good, like Mike was saying earlier, and it'll certainly keep your soil moisture in there for your trees. The grass, you know, it can get out of hand maintenance-wise. It's high maintenance, so certainly that mulch will help out with that aspect, and it'll keep your trees a little bit more healthier.
Now, I know that most people don't use pine needles around,
yeah.
So the pine needles is not an issue?
I'll follow up with that one because it's another argument I like to get into with times. A lot of people say, I'm putting down pine needles, it's making my soil more acidic. Well, when you actually look at the buffering capacity of your soil, that is the ability of your soil to resist pH change. Your soil is always going to want to gravitate back to what its natural pH is. And the amount of acidity that's going to be in those pine needles isn't really going to do much of anything in order to alter that pH drastically to the point where it's going to affect the apples. So I'm of the opinion use the pine needles. I think your biggest issue with the pine needles is they tend to be a fine textured mulch that can maybe be compacted. You might need to come in and fluff it up on occasion. And that's just the take-home message there. Mm-hmm.
Thank you much.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Let's see if we can get one more question answered. For instance, a caller wondered how they could control Japanese beetles without using insecticides. What do you think?
Big angry chickens.
And skunks.
Yeah, you get animals that like to eat them. So that's a very glib answer there. You can hand pick them, pull them off, and throw them into soapy water. Or it's the strategic use of traps, as in those Japanese beetle traps that attract them in. They attract in a whole bunch of them, but they only catch a percentage of what they're attracting in. If you actually want to use traps, you want to locate them as far away from the garden you're trying to protect as you can. The joke is they make great Christmas presents.
Mm-hmm. Are those traps effective for a period of time or...
They're effective most of the year. You know, the beetles come out just to do their mating, so they are effective as the beetle is emerging into its adult form. There's also, we have publications too on the Japanese beetle that's available online also that talks about different control methods, whether it's in the grub stage or in the adult stage.
And again, you'd go to learningstore.uwex.edu.
And definitely talk with your county extension office because we've handed out some of the fact sheets that aren't available through that site that have been developed just for Japanese beetle control. You got to be creative with it. There are some organics like diatomaceous earth that some people are saying works. I haven't experienced good luck with it, but other people claim they do.
Mike Maddox, Rock County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, and Chrissy Register, Walworth County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, are our guests today on Garden Talk. And we will talk more with them and take your calls after we check on the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Saturn Systems of Duluth, a software engineering firm providing an alternative to offshore development through their Outsource to America program. Saturn Systems, providing offshore to the North Shore, on the web at SaturnSYS.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Veep Steaks Fever, Bloody Days in Kabul, and Russians commandeer American Humvees in Georgia. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Plus, Anne of Green Gables turns 100 and looks surprisingly spry. We'll pay her a visit. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That's tonight from 6 till 8 on most of these Ideas Network stations. In Wisconsin, weather partly to mostly cloudy this afternoon with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs in the low to mid 80s.
It's 12 noon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we go through another edition of Garden Talk. Coming up in the next half hour after the news, we'll be taking calls about recycling water to water plants, how to prevent potato scab, what's wrong with a cherry tree that was broken in half in a storm, whether it has a chance of survival, and eliminating wild violets from the lawn. Those are questions that we'll be taking up. In the first hour, we talked about seed potatoes and trumpet vines, a rose arbor attracting butterflies and hummingbirds, black spots on your tomato, sweet pea plants, lilacs watering the lawn, and so much more. And we'd be glad to talk to you after the news. The number for you in Madison, 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on this edition of Garden Talk, and we're happy to have Mike Maddox of Janesville, Chrissy Register of Elkhorn. They are the Rock County and Walworth County UW Extension horticulture educators. And Mike and Chrissy, thanks again for coming in and talking with us today. It's been a lot of fun, and we'll take some more calls. If you'd like to join in, the number for you in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jane, next in Milwaukee. Hello, Jane.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to ask you what I should do with this beautiful tree we love very much. It's about 22 years old. And it was just laden with cherries, almost ripe at the end of June when we had all the water. and a third, a big branch of a tree, just cracked. It's cracked almost to the ground on that side of the tree, and we removed a third of the tree, wondering if there's any way to save it with that kind of a cracking around the base.
Well, that kind of cracking can be pretty detrimental to any tree, really, that it occurs to. And if you remove the third of it, you'll might get, you know, it might live for a couple of years, but it's probably not going to survive, depending on if the crack went, you know, clear down to the trunk or down to the ground or not. But I would say that, you know, if you love the tree and you want to keep it, then, you know, I would say go for it. But if it's cracked, that's all the way down. And it's what happens is it girdles the tree because that vascular system's not there on that part of the tree anymore. So you may have some more dieback, and slowly you may see, you know, the tree just branch by branch die back. So if it's a tree that you love, certainly if you don't want to take it down yet, then keep it around for a little while and see what happens. But you will probably see a little more die back on it here and there.
And I'd also like to use it as an opportunity to point out the importance of training young trees as you plant them. I see all too often individuals put a tree in the ground and they wait till about 15 years later in order to start pruning it then. A tree should be pruned a little bit each year in order to train it for some good sound architecture, in order to reduce the chances of failure during storm events. And, you know, to make sure there's a good central leader for tall shade trees, or to have like the small fruiting trees be properly pruned for ventilation and harvesting. There's a lot of techniques out there and a lot of literature to review on proper pruning that will help increase production of trees, as well as their architectural stability to reduce damage during storm events.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense, because about a year ago, my husband got my instructions wrong. I said I wanted to trim it down so it wasn't so tall, and we got it backwards, so it was pruned up, and so we had a lot of leverage on those branches, or those trunks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, good luck.
You.
All right,
Jean,
you just have to be patient, I guess, to be able to see what it looks like could happen to that. Paul in Cascade, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Mm-hmm. Potato scab again. Are there things you can do to the soil in the springtime to help prevent that problem or to lessen it?
Well, I'm not familiar with potato scab. Luckily, I haven't had to deal with that one myself. So I'm going to have to defer and say we're going to either contact your local county extension office and have them look up some information on county on the scab, or, again, go to our website, The Learning Store, and see what our publications say. I'm going to assume there's not a real good treatment you can do for potato scab, but good crop rotation is what's going to be key for that.
Is the rest of the potato edible?
Off the top of my head, I do not know. That is a problem I have not experienced.
Okay, let's switch gears and go to worm casting.
Oh, okay, that's better.
Are they a really good thing?
Are you buying them, or?
I did yesterday.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, worm castings, I mean, it's basically compost. It's fertilizer. I don't know what the nitrogen content is, but I don't think it's going to be like the caller earlier who was talking about the poultry manure she was using. Yeah. I think if you used it in the garden, it would be a benefit. You could top dress it around existing plants, or you can use it as a soil amendment earlier in the season. I try to do a little bit of vermiculture myself at home. I have a couple containers that I throw coffee grounds in, vegetable parts, and I stop by the gas station, pick up some red wigglers every so often, throw them in there, and I've got a couple containers where I'm generating worm castings that I use in my own garden.
Well, it must be potent stuff, because they warn you not to use very much of it.
Yeah, it's probably going to be pretty rich. I wouldn't put more than, well, definitely always follow the instructions as labeled. But for what I do is I'll just take a handful, and I personally choose to use it in some containers as a little bit of a container fertilizer, and I'll mix it in with the potting soil that I add to a container and use it that way. But that's just the way I do it.
You must have read the label, because that's what the directions say.
Oh, well, that makes me feel good, because I was actually making it up as I was going along.
No.
Okay, Paul, good luck to you. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Bruce in La Crosse next. What's on your mind, Bruce?
Well, I've got lots of what I think are wild violets in my grass, and I understand that
one way to treat these to actually paint the leaves with a borax solution, but I haven't found that successful.
Well, a lot of the violets that grow are native to Wisconsin, so they will be prolific if they have the right environment. And I certainly have them all over my yard. I think it's just a dependent. It's a broadleaf, so if you use a broadleaf herbicide, and that would be after near the frost or after the frost would be your best bet for that if you do want to get rid of them. I guess it's just a matter of opinion, but I think if you used a broadleaf herbicide, or if you wanted to go more culturally and just do some pulling, I know that can be a big duty, but certainly I think that would be your best bet in the fall after the first frost or so would be for that control.
We'd be gone, and it has some effect. But
did you use was it a granular or liquid form?
Liquid.
Okay, because a lot of people will try to treat these plants and they actually misuse the product, or they're missing out the way to maximize the benefit of using products when they choose to use them. As Chrissy said, when you do an application near the first frost or after the first frost, after that cold snap actually induces the waxy covering on the leaves, the cuticle, to actually crack. And so when you come in with a liquid herbicide at that time, especially a broadleaf weed killer, it'll get through those cracks and be more likely to get into the leafy tissue, absorbed in, and then translocated down into the roots. And that allows you to kill it at the root. So a lot of people, you know, they'll come out in the early spring, all gung-ho on killing weeds, and they'll spray it all then, and they don't get much effect. Save all your broadleaf weed control for the fall. Do it after the first frost, and that's going to help you out a lot for doing it. If you're going to use a granular type, make sure the leaf is wet when you apply it, so the granule actually sticks to the leaf for better absorption into it. I've actually have them in my lawn too, and I've kind of given up in spots and just enjoy the bloom they make.
Okay. Thank you.
You may need two years of doing your treatment too to really get them under control.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, I've learned this too. Nothing's 100%.
Yeah.
Nothing's a one-time shot.
And it's never permanent.
And it's never permanent. It is an ongoing thing with a yard. People want quick, easy solutions, and you know, unless you're going to move into a condo, there is nothing.
Well, that's what my wife would like.
Bruce, thanks for your call. Good luck to you. And if you'd like to join in, there may be time for your call in Madison, 263-1890, or toll free at 800-642-1234. Carrie in Appleton is next. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, good afternoon.
Sure.
I have a question about using what I call gray water from my kitchen to water my plants outside. This time of year, I'm rinsing a lot of produce or I'm boiling corn, and I'm wondering if I can safely use that water on my plants.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. I think gray water is fantastic to use, and it's certainly safe, and you can use it in all kinds of applications, whether you save it through the winter to water your house plants or if you're watering your outdoor gardens. It certainly is beneficial to, you know, reuse that water.
And is there any, for example, if I boil beets, obviously the water has a pigmented color. I mean, that's no problem. Boiling eggs and using that water is not a problem.
I don't think that's as much of an issue as any soap you would have in the water. Soap is going to be containing phosphorus and
right.
Is there potassium? Yeah, phosphorus. And that can be an issue for pollution and excess phosphorus in the water. I think I've read somewhere one time about areas that were having drains, especially like from laundry, discharging right into waterways and creating some algal blooms. The other things with using soaps that may be in the water is soap's a great natural insecticide, but depending on a soap formulation, you might get some phototoxicity if you were to spray it like on the leaves of the plant when doing some watering. So if you're going to be using anything, gray water, as Chrissy said, is a great way to recycle that water. But if you're going to be using soapy water, you might want to test it in small areas in your garden to make sure there is no negative effect. And just be careful with the concept of using soapy water because of some of the phosphorus issues in some areas.
But if I stay soap-free, I should be pretty safe.
I would think yes.
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic.
All right, Carrie, good luck. Thanks very much. Appreciate hearing from you. Joe in Sun Prairie is next. Hi, Joe.
Hello. We planted some dianthus in the front of the house with about a 3.5-inch stone border separating it from the grass, and have found that the grass still has found a way into the dianthus. I was wondering First of all, how much I can pull those dianthus up to try and get the grass out on the roots. And second of all, if there might be something that I can apply that would remove the grass but leave the dianthus.
Well, the dianthus is nice because it is one of our perennials that you can cut back and it'll rebloom for, similar to an annual. But when you get the grass in your dianthus, what you may want to do, you know, in this coming fall is just take your dianthus out, actually, and remove it, and then remove that grass, or if you want to use, some sort of spray on that grass. But, you know, just digging that grass out or possibly using a spade and along that edge there and making a real clean edge once or twice a year will really prevent that grass from moving into that bed. So that way, if you can do that, I think that would really calm that grass down that's moving in there. And that edge, you know, you'd want to go all the way through your grass into the soil profile there so that you cut those roots so they can't move through that soil into your bed of dianthus there.
Okay. If I pull it up in the fall, do I replant it in the fall or do I try and preserve it for the spring?
No, I would. You could certainly replant it. You know, just pull it up, do a little weeding or make your edge there with your spade and certainly just get it back in the ground and it'll be fine for next year.
Very good. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate your call. And Hansa is in Nina. Hansa, what's on your mind today?
Well, I have a question for you. What's the difference between chokecherry and buckthorn trees? I have so many in my yard. Some people call that that's a nuisance. That's a weed. Cut it out because it spreads too much. One has a small black cherry-type things. Another side is a bigger green seeds are those. How do we find the difference?
Well, there's definitely publications out there on identifying buckthorn because it is listed as the invasive species. But with the buckthorn seed, right now it'll be in its turning into its black stage. And one good way to tell buckthorn from other plants is in the fall, it will hold its leaves a lot longer than other plants will. It's one of our last trees to start to turn color and actually drop its leaves. And it also holds some of its berries throughout the year. That goes for in the spring, too. It's one of our first trees to have foliage on it. So those are two just good ways to identify buckthorn in that situation. Another way to identify buckthorn is if you take a nail or a knife or something and just scratch the bark, it will have an orangish color underneath the initial bark. And those are just two general ways to identify it. Also, of course, it has a small thorn on its branches. And again, the publications would really help you out in those. You could find certainly online through many resources, you could find how to identify them.
But what is the other one which has a greenish, bigger seeds? It's almost like a 1/2 inch or slightly bigger. They are not a small cherry.
You know, my imagination's running wild on what that could be. I would recommend taking a branch of that to your local extension office for ID. Sometimes over the radio, it's difficult to do ID because what you're describing is not what's coming to my mind. So I would take about a foot-long branch with leaves and berries and flowers on it if you can. Take it to your local county extension office so we can get that identified that way.
Thank you.
Okay, Hansa, thank you very much for your call. And we're talking today on Garden Talk with Mike Maddox and Chrissy Register. And Lisa is next in Pewaukee. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, I have a big problem. Help! I've got tons of poison ivy.
Ooh.
Tons. And I'm not sure what to do with it.
Don't touch it.
You know what? I don't know if I'm even allergic to it, if that's even possible.
Yeah,
my husband is terribly allergic.
I am too. I am too. So I have got this poison ivy radar that I just... Okay, there it is. Stay away from that garden. Poison ivy is actually going to be a woody plant. And you're going to need to have something labeled for killing a woody plant. And I would recommend an herbicide. Unless you are definitely not allergic to it and want to try pulling it, I would recommend coming in with something labeled as a poison ivy killer, a brush killer. Typically, those products are containing like triclopyr. And you'll need to take the product, follow the instructions for application. You can probably try spraying it on the plant if it's some sort of liquid form for a spray. You can try painting it on with a paintbrush and if it's mixed in with some other plants. But that's how you would take care of it. Doing it now in the latter half of the year, in the latter half of the summer is better because it's going to, again, be sucked into the plant, and the plant's moving all its resources down to its roots, getting ready for overwintering. So this will move the herbicide down to the root. As we said earlier, be consistent. Don't expect 100% results, but this is the game you're going to have to play until you don't see it come back anymore.
Wonderful. I will try that. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, Lisa. Good luck to you. And Mackenzie's next in Maple. Hello, Mackenzie.
Hi. I just had a question about apple trees that I've got in my backyard. The trees are just laden with fruit, tons and tons and tons of fruit. But they're all relatively small as to what I'm assuming the size of the apples should be. Even last year, right after we bought the place, when we picked them, they were all pretty small, not a whole lot bigger than golf balls, smaller than tennis balls. I'm wondering how I can encourage bigger fruit, even if it's not quite so many.
I would have to say maybe doing some pruning early season, and that would, you know, the more buds you have and the more fruit production that's going on, that means that there's less energy going to each one of those fruits, so that way they're a little bit smaller in size. There are some other methods that you can use to do that, and certainly just removing some of the smaller apples when they're becoming right as they're starting to grow. That's one way to do it. Just having less will make an apple larger, so that it can push that energy into one apple and not several apples on that branch.
Okay. And I've been told by a couple of different people that you always have to spray for worms every year without fail. Is that correct?
Yes, unless you just start to get creative. I've met a few growers out there now who are, and these are backyard growers, by no means are these orchard growers, that are doing what's known as apple bagging. And that is, they're coming in with basically a little Ziploc type bag, and they've cut the little bottom corners off to allow for drainage. And as the first fruit are starting to form, they'll come in and put this bag over the little small fruit, thin off the ones as that they don't want, and staple it around there, around the fruit. And when I first heard this, I thought, this is going to be applesauce on a tree. But when I've watched this more and more people do this, I've seen some of the articles come out on it, you're actually getting beautiful fruit forming inside those bags without the use of pesticides on them. I actually found a video, and I forgot which university put it out, but I put it on the Rock County Extension website that's actually showing a demonstration of how people are doing apple bagging. So if you go to my website at rock.uwx.edu and go to my horticulture page, I've got a list of all the questions that come in each week, and on one of those weeks I put up a link for apple bagging. I would recommend checking that out, because it's, if you have a couple trees for the backyard gardener type, this is something that you might want to consider.
Yeah, I've got 6 or 7 trees, plus there's a pear tree back there as well, and I'm still trying to figure out what kind of apples they are. There's so many resources, but none of them seem to have what I'm looking for.
Yeah, and it's very hard to tell some apples. I know sometimes people bring in apples and go, can you taste this and tell me what it is? And I'm like, you know, if it's not in a pie, I'm really not interested eating it. That's just my preference. It's hard to tell a lot of apples. You might want to, if they're older trees, you might want to take them to an older established orchard and see if the growers there can identify them.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Mackenzie, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. And Grant in Appleton is next. Hello, Grant.
Hi, I've got a tree here that I got from my friend's house, and so I got the roots out, and it's actually in the back of my truck still, and I noticed the roots are full of ants, and they're carrying little, like, eggs or whatever, little white things, and I'm wondering, what can I do? I'm not really familiar with pesticides, kind of an organic gardener, so I'm not...
I got an idea. Wash them off with soapy water and plant the tree. The ants aren't doing anything with the roots. You just got a colony that moved into that root ball. And
yeah.
I just plant the tree and wash it off. That it should be a non-issue.
Kind of wash it with soapy water?
I wouldn't even go crazy with it. I would just plant the tree, water it in real well. It's not going to be... They're not doing damage to the tree. Ants don't do damage to the tree. I get phone calls all the time with my trees with ants. The ants are killing my tree. Typically, when you have ants, especially in the older, larger trees that you get in the landscape, they just found a hollowed spot. They're making their home in there. They didn't cause the problem. So they're in large trees, they're doing you a favor by letting you know your tree has a decay spot in it. They're not causing the problems. If you just got them in your root ball, not an issue. They're hitchhikers.
Okay. Thanks,
All right. Thank you very much. And again, you've got this event coming up, Mike, September 6th at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville.
Yeah, September 6th, 1 to 5. Come early because it's while supplies last. It's free tomato taste testing, free fried green tomatoes, lots of free education about gardening. Get more information at our website, rotarygardens.org.
Okay, and that is Saturday, September 6th, and runs from 1 to 5 in the afternoon?
Correct.
And the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, located at 1455 Palmer Drive. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a real quick question answered. Tom in La Crosse, go ahead.
Hello, yes. Thanks for taking my call. See, I got a question. I got a pear tree in my front yard that we planted probably about 8 years ago now. And it's a beautiful tree, big tree, real full. But we never get any buds. We never get
and the short answer to not having any buds on his pear tree would be?
It doesn't like you. I would see if it's an appropriate tree for that area. It may not be cold hardy. I forgot where you said you're from, but it could be getting damage from
winter.
La Crosse. It could be winter damage and such. It could be over-fertilization. That's been a theme for today.
All right, and check your local extension office. We'll also give you good information on that question. Thanks, Mike, for being here today.
That's always fun.
And Chrissy, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
Look forward to talking with the two of you again. I'm Jim Packard. Martinez White, the on-air producer today. If you'd like a copy of the program, it's available from the radio store. And ask for program 822F, as in Friday. Coming up Monday, Larry's back. He'll be talking with Mary T. Bell of the Dry Food Store on food drying with an attitude. And Monday at 11:45, the weather guy Steve Ackerman and John Martin blow hot and cold on Wisconsin's weather.